Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I know you were just with me this wonderful Sunday morning, but as I told you, I'm a very, very hardworking gentleman, and I am excited to bring another guest on today to talk about one of the issues that's in my sphere when it comes to this whole podcast situation with foreign policy. So we're going to talk about BRICS, a lot about China, and even some electric vehicle stuff, because I know my guest today is pretty well educated in that area. So I won't keep you guys too long in this. I already did my shilling this morning. Make sure you hit all the links below where you can find my guests and everything I got going on, the wonderful supplements I got behind me, you know, Element Tea, Fox Sun's Coffee, Tiger Fitness, all that good stuff. And without further ado, let's go.
What is up, everybody? My name is Kyle Matovic. I am the host of the In Liberty and Health podcast, where we talk all things liberty, health and wellness, and beyond. My hope is to encourage and spread the message of liberty and physical and mental well-being. I hope you enjoy all the topics we talk about with our guests. We're on all major streaming platforms, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Man, I'm doing as good as anyone could do getting buried by his 13-year-old son on leg day.
I'm not going to apologize for not being on this podcast because I got to go see Metallica. So if that's a problem, kiss my ass.
Okay? I am.
All right.
Good afternoon, one more time, everybody. And today I have with me Mr. Carl Zaw. How are you doing today, Carl?
Hi, Kyle. How are you?
Excellent. And I hope you're doing well. And I'm really looking forward to having this conversation today. So I guess first things first, give my listeners a introduction of yourself and everything that you do.
Oh, I'm a prolific ship poster online. I do have a Twitter account. I post a lot. But I mostly post everything about China. I run a podcast, Silk and Steel Podcast, which covers everything China, history, politics, and culture. I was born in China in 1976, right after the Cultural Revolution ended. And I grew up in China I grew up in China in the decade of the 1980s. I came to United States in 1990, right after the Tiananmen Square protest, because my dad was studying in U.S. in 1985 for his PhD. And after Tiananmen Square protest, he decided he's not going to go back to China. Instead, he's going to bring his family to the U.S. So I came to U.S. in 1990, started eighth grade. Yeah, I started eighth grade and, you know, did my high school, college, or in the U.S. And now I am in Bali, Indonesia. So
nice. Well, I'm not quite as familiar with Indonesia as I'm sure you are. Where is kind of Indonesia in regards to like foreign policy and culture? Because, you know, I'm sure you know from being in the West for a brief period that, you know, we have this God, guts, guns, and glory kind of mentality where, you know, it's America and we're the best country in the world. And, you know, we work hard, play hard, all this kind of stuff. What's the culture like? And then obviously, you know, the U.S. mindset is that we're the global empire here. We rule over the world with an iron fist. Where does Indonesia kind of stand in all that?
That's a good question because, you know, not many people know a lot about Indonesia because Indonesia is actually a big country. It's if you superimpose a map of Indonesia on the map of Europe, it will stretch from the city of London all the way to the border of Afghanistan. That's how big Indonesia is. Yeah. It's because of Maquiador projection, you know, that makes everything in the north super huge. You know, Greenland looks like the size of South America. That's why Indonesia being on the equator, it looks small. But the real size of Indonesia is like almost a continent unto itself. And it is has the fourth largest population on the planet. You know, the top three is China, India, and U.S. And okay. Indonesia is right after number four. But it's for some reason, not many people knew about it. And Indonesia is also the world's most populous Muslim country. It's a Muslim majority country. But where I am, Bali, is actually a Hindu majority island. I believe it's the last Hindu majority island in the Indonesian archipelago. Like most of the Southeast Asia used to be all Hindu and Buddhist. And that changed around like 14th, 15th century when Islam started to be adopted by the local rulers. So the Islam spread pretty quick. And then, you know, they pretty soon took over Java Island, which is the most populous island in Indonesia. So all the Hindu priests and the ruling class, they escaped Java and came to Bali. So Bali is like the last bastion of kind of what the traditional maritime Southeast Asia would be look like. You know, it's still majority Hindu today. My wife is local Balinese. So we have they have a lot of religious holidays. Like, seems like there's a religious holiday every month. And then my wife, she's kind of obligated to travel back to her home village to celebrate with, you know, her family and stuff. So I just tag along.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually very fascinating. And that's kind of what I've heard of Asian cultures. Now, the only places I've been have obviously been to the United States and then to the Bahamas, the Dominican Republic. But my understanding of a lot of, you know, East Asian cultures is that they have very, very tight-knit family structures. And it sounds like your experience there is kind of cements that idea.
Yeah, it's a very, there's definitely the family and the community bond is definitely a lot tighter than the West. Because I mean, in US, it's everything is pretty atomized nowadays. You know, first of all, it's a US is the land of the immigrant. Everybody is coming from somewhere, and after the Industrial Revolution, you know, everything get atomized to the nuclear family, but you know, now the nuclear family is not doing too so well in US. So everything get atomized to individual level, but here you still feel very much part of a community. There's like certain obligations you have toward your home village, etc. But I'm just here in Bali for the surf. That's why.
As of this past Monday, it had snowed pretty hard here in Pennsylvania, unfortunately. And I tell people all the time, look, if my wife and I ever move out of Pennsylvania, I am never picking up a snow shovel again. If I never saw snow again in my life, it would not be too soon. And the place we would probably go is down south to Florida. I had a job interview down there, and I was going to work for a General Motors dealership, but unfortunately, it just would have been so much of a ridiculous kind of move. So I guess I kind of pose another question that I was kind of curious about. As somebody who's kind of lived all over the place, what is the class mobility kind of like in Asian countries? Because in here, or at least like in my state in Pennsylvania, it's pretty cheap to live. But because it's cheap to live here, you can't really move out of Pennsylvania. And I feel like a lot of people all over the U.S. are kind of in that same situation, unless you're in like New York or California, where the cost of living is really high. If you're in a flyover state or somewhere like I live, you can't really move out. You're kind of stuck here. Is that different in places that you've been, or what's that like?
Well, I mean, here in Indonesia, most people, like Bali is a tourist island. Its sure. main state is tourism. So actually, a lot of people from all over Indonesia came to Bali to work. But a lot of people also leave Bali to work in to work in the capital, Jakarta, just because that's where there's more opportunity over there. And traditionally, the Balinese men in particular, they would go out, you know, they either work locally in the tourism industry, or they go working on cruise ships. So, you know, you have like their wives are known as like the cruise ship widows, because they won't see their husband for like 6 months. Yeah, that's how it is in Bali. I mean, I can't speak too much because I've only been here since 2019, basically since COVID. But in China, it's quite different, because China, there's a drastic change in the last 40 years. You know, when I was born in China in 1976, you cannot move around so much, because you are basically tied to the place of your birth by something called the household registration. So, for example, My parents, they were sent down to the Tibetan region of China during the Cultural Revolution. My dad, right after his graduation from college, and my mom after graduating nursing school, they were sent to like the Tibetan highlands. And that's where they met and got married. But when they gave birth to me, my household registration would be tied to my birthplace. My parents didn't want me to stay with them because they felt like, first of all, it's like 4,000 meters up in the in the air. And they also wanted me to have better educational opportunities. So they sent me, my mom actually went to her hometown in Chongqing in Southwest China to give birth to me. And then I stayed with my grandma. But the problem is, in China back in those days, if you don't have household registration in your your locality, you cannot go to school. And you cannot go to kindergarten, you cannot go to school, you cannot work. Because in 1970s, China was very much still a command economy. So everything is like government assigned. Like, this is why my parents got sent to Tibet in the first place, because when people graduate from college, the government would assign you a job. You don't have much of a choice. Like, my dad originally was supposed to be sent somewhere else, but his classmates kind of bribed the school official, so he got shafted. He got sent to the Tibetan Highlands, and luckily my grandma, she worked as a school teacher, so she know a lot of people. She know a lot of parents who had various connections. So somehow I was able to, they were able to, they took several years, but finally they were able to change my local registration to my mother's hometown, which is where I was born. But it took a while. And it's to the point where my mom even had trouble giving birth to me because I'm the second child. In 1976, that's when China's just started to experiment with family planning, one child policy. They started in selective cities. So my mom's hometown, Chongqing, was one of the first to implement one child policy. That's why when I went to school in China, I think I was the only one who had a sibling, older sister. And when my mom went to the hospital to give birth to me, she almost wasn't admitted because the hospital director says, like, what are you doing? We're like the model hospital for doing birth family planning. If you're gonna give birth to your second child, that's gonna screw up our reputation. But my mom's like, wait, you don't understand. You know, they have the one child policy in Chongqing, but where we work, because at that time the policy was first rolled out, it was different. The one child policy didn't extend to the national minorities. It didn't extend to Tibetans. But he also didn't extend to like the majority Han Chinese who work in the Tibetan area. Like my parents, they would be allowed to have two children. So I was actually legal, but my mom trying to explain the policy to them, but the hospital director wasn't buying it. He's like, what? You mean Tibet is not part of China? What do you mean you have a different policy? And so in the end, my grandma had to find my mom a different hospital, again, through my grandma's connection, because she knows a lot of people. So I was allowed to be born. And then it was a very different time back then in 1976. You're not allowed to have your job, but when I was going through school, I remember I was being told, my parents are like, don't cause trouble, because if you did something bad in school, that's going to go on your file. And that file is going to follow you through the rest of your life to the time when they assign jobs when you graduate. I was like, holy shit. But obviously, that's not true anymore, because China shifted to a market economy. So, you know, now government do not assign jobs for college graduates and you have, you're responsible for your own career path. And there's a lot more freedom of movement in China. You're not, you know, like a tied to the place of your birth anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so, I mean, like it's almost undescribable, the kind of the huge transformation China experienced in the last 40 years, you know, since mm-hmm. I was born. It because when I was born in 1980s, China was a very, very poor country. Like when my dad came to US to study in 1985, you know, his professor would ask him, you know, like, in China, how much did you earn? Because my dad was an instructor in university in China before he went to US to pursue his PhD. He said he was making like equivalent of $300 USD per month. And wow. The professor was shocked. It was like, how can you live in that kind of salary? But in China back then, again, you know, like the standard of living is different, because back then you don't have to pay for your housing. My dad, the university assigned him an apartment, and you don't have to pay for healthcare. Like if you're an urban resident, if you're attached to like a state-owned enterprise, including university. So when I was 13, I contracted hepatitis A, and I was hospitalized for like a couple months. But I didn't have to pay for a dime, because I went to the hospital of the Chongqing number one textile factory. That was because my grandma worked as a teacher at the school that was attached to the Chongqing number one textile factory. Also back then, it's very socialist. So each state-owned enterprise, sure, they will have their own hospital, their own schools. So all the, you know, all the families of their employee of the factory, they would receive free healthcare. So I was hospitalized for 2 months. I didn't have to pay anything. But then again, that was only limited to like urban residents, urban residents who work in a state-owned enterprise. Like that healthcare did not extend to like the vast majority of Chinese back then, which still live in the countryside. In 1980, China did a census in 1982. That's when China first hit the 1 billion mark in terms of population. But 80% of the population back then, 800 million Chinese, still live on the farm, in the countryside, on subsistence farming. Yeah, and the cities, that's why like they couldn't extend, like, for example, the free healthcare to everyone, because it's like they wouldn't be able to afford it. So it was only limited to the urban residents who work for a state-owned enterprise. But in 1980s, that system was already starting to break down, because China started to experiment with market reform. Because before once you get hired on, it's like cradle to grave. You like kind of guarantee a job until you retire. But when China started market reform, the state-owned factory already, there was no private industry back then in early 1980s. Mm-hmm. So the state-owned industry started to experimenting with like hiring contractual workers from the countryside, where they don't have to pay for the healthcare. They don't have to promise them lifetime employment. They pay by, you know, the contracted work. And eventually they allow private enterprise. I remember in 1980s, you know, a lot of the first people who got rich in China are those private entrepreneurs, and especially those small business owner, like restaurant owners, the people who open a street side restaurant, even like a food stand. There was a joke that the old grandma who sells the tea eggs on the street makes more than the professors who work on the nuclear weapons. But wow. It was true because at that time the professor's salary was set at a fixed level by the state. But if you're a private entrepreneur, you know, you can make as much money as you want.
Yeah,
the sky is the limit. So there was a lot of changes. And I remember in late, one of the trigger for the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989 was the runaway inflation, because when China started market reform, there was two pricing systems. One system was set by the state for all the state-owned enterprises, you know, how much they can, how much things should cost, how much thing they should sell for. And the other system is the market price, you know. So what happened is a lot of people who have the connection, who can, like, say, get material from a state-owned enterprise at the state-set artificially deflated price, and then turn around and sell them on open market, you can make a killing. So there was a lot of corruption. And when they tried to lift the price control, it kind of triggered high inflation. And a lot of the urban residents start getting left behind. Like, people who are getting paid salaries, like school teachers, professors, doctors. So there was a widespread protest in 1989, originally to protest the corruption and protest the high inflation, but eventually that turned into a political movement. That led to the final crackdown, like 2 months later. It was crazy times, because to tell you just how much big difference happened in early 80s to late 80s. In the early 80s, like my sister is 4 years older than me. And so I would use some of her, like, unused school notebook when I went to school. So I saw one of her old unused notebook from 1979, right? And on the back, still full of political slogans, like, be vigilant against the evil Soviet social imperialism. Like, so when I saw that in mid-1980s, I already felt like, wow, that language is kind of strident, you know, like, is that necessary? At that time, when I grew up in early 80s, I remember there was very little cultural input from the outside world, but we would have movies and TV series imported from, like, socialist countries like former Yugoslavia, because Yugoslavia back then was still on good terms with China, but China, Sino-Soviet split was still going on, so we wouldn't have any Soviet movies. But in the mid-80s, I start seeing, like, Soviet movies showing on like War and Peace and then Soviet movies from 80s and 70s starts showing up on state television. So that's when I was like, oh, maybe the Sino-Soviet split is over. So that did happen in 1989 when Gorbachev finally visited Beijing, and that's right in the middle of the Tiananmen Square protests. And that's also a lot of the foreign tourists were actually in Beijing, not tourists, sorry, journalists were actually in Beijing to cover the historical summit between Gorbachev and Deng Xiaoping. It just so happened when they came to town, they say, oh, holy crap, there's like a 1 million man protest in the middle of the Tiananmen Square. Like, they were supposed to receive Gorbachev in the Tiananmen Square, but they couldn't because there was a million students sitting in there. So they had to, like, have his reception at the Beijing airport. So that's why there was a lot of media coverage of the Tiananmen Square, because a lot of the tourists were flying in at that time. So around that time, I was like 12 or 13. I was just, like, kind of old enough to know kind of what's going on. And I just remember I was, like, kind of jealous of the university students, because my dad was a lecturer at the Chongqing University. So we live on the university campus at the university provided housing. I kind of grew up around us college students, and I was like, damn, they don't have to go to school and they just go protest. Shit, man, I want that. Because I went to junior high, we still had to go to school. So one day I said, I think there was a time when the Chinese government also, like, they went back and forth on whether to recognize the student movement as patriotic. There was a time when one faction of the government kind of won out temporarily. They say, oh, the student movement is patriotic, but you guys should go back to school. But I use the opportunity to write something in our school, because my real goal is to get us out of class. I don't want to go to school. And right. I just say, yeah, see, the government said the student movement is patriotic. We should go out in the street and to support them. And at that time, like everybody in my class, like they hail me as a hero. It felt pretty good. our teacher was pretty hard ass. She wouldn't let us out. But after, I remember going, we lived in Chongqing, but you know, the main focus of the protests, of course, is in Beijing. But there was protests all over China, in different parts of China. I would go to the protest after school, because everybody went, like our teachers, you know, our teachers went to protest, and it's pretty wild. It was like it's a mass movement, because you have all these people on the street. It's kind of festive. I'm kind of going all over the place. So stop me anytime.
No, you're good. This is awesome, because I've really got to talk to too many people who've like been in Asia or lived in Asia. So one thing I actually kind of wanted to hone in on was the whole idea of a social credit system. I have a friend who follows me on Twitter and I follow him. Yeah, I see you're laughing. I think these people that live here in America, I think, have this dystopian view of China. And from what you've said here alone, I think if they sat down and listened to you, they would be like, oh, like we've been lied to. And I think this is the case, because I believed a lot of this stuff. And then over time, it was just like little tidbits planted in my mind that, hey, maybe what we're being told about China isn't true. So I have a guy, his name's like Waffleless Rex or something like that. He was originally from China and now he lives in California, I believe. And him and I always kind of like go back and forth, not like a bad way. Like we talk about this stuff, because one of my main goals with the show is to help put out information that debunks a lot of the Cold War propaganda against China, because I consider myself to be like a right wing, you know, capitalist libertarian. But one of my principal beliefs is being anti-war and anti-imperialist. And I see the people who are much like me, you know, kind of a capitalist libertarian type, who look at our government and say, like, our government's encroaching too much on our civil liberties, and they're sending our tax dollars to go fight these unnecessary wars, like in Israel or in Ukraine. And they're going to do that with Taiwan. But like the same group of people who want to protest the wars in, you know, Ukraine are all for, hey, let's go fight a war with Iran and China. I'm like, you guys are nuts. Like, we don't want to do that. You know, we should be trading with these people. So what is there a social credit score in China? Because if they heard you say, oh, this goes in your file, they're going to think, oh, his social credit score is going down. So what is the situation with that?
Yeah, that's an urban myth. I mean, there's so back in the days, there was like back in my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, and even in the 1980s, there was a much tighter, strict social control. You know, I told you, like, it was what I said, it was true. Like, back then, they do have maintain your files starting from like grade school, right? Mm-hmm. And I used to be scared, you know, oh shit, if I get in trouble in school, it's gonna follow me the rest of my life. Because that was a case, like for example, like everyone have to like confess about their class background. Like in 1950s, in 1949, when People's Republic was first founded, in the beginning that they tell everyone to write down their class background. So my grandmother was smart, because her dad, my great granddad, was actually one of the biggest landlords in the Chongqing area, and her older brother was the district mayor in Chongqing, and in her words, if her brother had survived until 1949, he will for sure be shot in public execution. But he was smart, because her dad, even though came from a large landowning family, his hobby was being practiced Chinese medicine. Like he was a legit Chinese like a Chinese doctor. So on the on her class background, then my grandma put urban professional because her dad, and then but my grandpa, who actually grew up very poor, my grandpa came from like a small land owning family, but her but his older brother was opium addict and kind of smoked the family fortune away, and then and later, like the neighbors, some big bully, bigger landlord, I guess, somehow took, finangled took all their land away. So my grandpa grew up like only in his like first 10 years he was able to when his family still had money, he was educated home, and like he had a private tutor and all that, but. By the time before he was a teenager, his family got completely bankrupt. So he actually grew up really poor, and he did everything. He did as a chef's apprentice. He worked as a vegetable vendor. I mean, he was like a pull yourself up by the bootstrap type of guy, mm-hmm. And somehow he got himself an education. He went to night school at Chongqing University, and he finangled himself a position as a teacher. And later he actually, one of the investors, set up a school with him as a school principal. He's vain. So he didn't want to put that he was poor, his class background. So he wrote landlord as his class. Uh-huh. So he got jacked during Cultural Revolution, mm-hmm. because his class background and also the school that he was worked for was attached to a textile factory. It was previously manufacturing like the mm-hmm. army uniform for the nationalist government, the government the communists overthrew. So because of that, because of my grandpa's history, my mom wasn't allowed to go to college. She was just not allowed to go to college. That was the way it was during Cultural Revolution. And even like my mom tried to, denounce her dad and all that, it didn't work. Like she was just not allowed to go to college. And same thing happened to my other side of the family, my dad's side of the family. My grandpa was my dad's side was also a doctor, but again, they came from a small landowning family, mm-hmm. and then they have and he during the Japanese occupation, my grandpa went to because his residence in the countryside, but his clinic is in the town. So every time he goes through the town, he has to go through the Japanese checkpoint. Because around that time, all the Chinese towns and cities still have city walls around them, and the Japanese will put sentries at the city at the gate of the city wall to check everybody's IDs. And the Japanese soldier require all the Chinese people to salute them when they pass by. And my grandpa, because he felt he's like an educated elite, and he felt deeply humiliating that he has to salute a Japanese soldier. So he pretend he didn't hear it. He hear the Japanese soldier's command. But the Japanese soldier wouldn't have it. They grabbed him and they slapped him across the face in public, to discipline for not like showing proper respect to the Japanese soldier. So he felt deeply humiliated. And at the time, he decided to find the underground resistance. There was no underground resistance. There was no communist underground resistance in the time, in the place where my grandpa's hometown was. He was all like nationalist, so he joined the nationalist party. They even give him a job as like the propaganda chief of the area because he was educated. He can, because back before 1940s, there's only like 10% of the Chinese population could read or write, right? So he was one of the few. So he was made a propaganda chief. So, I don't know exactly what did he did. I in my picture, he's like the like in that scene from the Monty Python movie, Life of Brian, you know, going around the town and painting anti-Japanese slogans. But luckily, he wasn't caught. But after the Japanese surrender, the nationalist government from Chongqing came to take over the area, and the official came and they say, okay, well, thank you for your service. You can go home now. We can take over from here. So he went back to his civilian life. But because of that, he remained a member of Nationalist Party. So when the communists took over, like, you served the old regime. And so because of that, he got shafted. And none of my dad's siblings were allowed to go to college, except his oldest brother, who went to college before communists took over. Mm-hmm. And his second oldest brother, despite having the best grade, got the highest score in the college entrance exam in his local area, was not allowed to go to college because of my grandpa. And my dad, when my dad graduated high school, there was a period of relaxation in the policy. At that time, one of the top communist leaders said, oh, you know, people should be judged by their own action, not by what their parents did. So that brief period of relaxation is when my dad was allowed to go to college, became the only one from his family to go to college. And so this was kind of the background of China during a cultural revolution. Back then, it was true. It was kind of everything very tightly controlled. They maintained file on you, you know, on your past, on your family's past. But in the 1980s, that all started to change. You know, one of the major factors was after the Tiananmen protests, ironically, because at that time, the government was deeply unpopular after the crackdown of Tiananmen Square protests. And you also faced a diplomatic isolation from a lot of the Western countries. And so in return, the Chinese government basically made a bargain with the Chinese people. It's like, okay, as long as, you know, if you don't interfere in political protest stuff, I will let you make money. You can get rich. And so basically, a lot of the old social controls were lifted, especially when, I mean, it's a lot easier to have the social control when the whole society runs on state-owned command economy, right? They can keep a tab on you, you know, keep a file on you. But like after, when you can have your own business, your own job, be your, you know, own boss, I mean, that kind of goes out of the window. And so it's like the cultural revolution to like someone like my youngest cousin who was born in 1990s would be as remote to her as like something from the Jurassic age, you know, it's like dinosaur age. Right. The short end of it is there's no social credit system. What happened is at the time, there were some localities in China that were experimenting with kind of the digital ID. And then, you know, how they would keep track of people. But it was there was no like national there's no national database. Right. Mm-hmm. To keep tabs on everybody's social credit system. And that's another thing, you know, people say, oh, but in US, you know, you have credit scores and that follows you around. In China, they don't have there's no credit card. There's not widespread use of credit card in China until very recently. So they just directly leap into mobile payment. You have you can do everything on your phone. You have a WeChat. You have WeChat or Alipay, and you can just link that to your Chinese bank account and just scan a QR code to pay. And that's what most people do. They hardly use cash anymore. At least that's when I visited in 2019. I kind of. There's only like few places that still take, you know, require cash, but I mostly I got by just with my phone. But it was not easy for foreign tourists back then, because, you know, they to have a WeChat Pay link. The WeChat Pay back then could not link to a foreign bank. So it only links to a Chinese bank. And it's a pain in the butt for a foreigner to get a Chinese bank account. My dad went to try to get a Chinese bank account, and my cousin's like, "Oh, no problem. I know this guy from the bank, but he will take care of you." And then we went to the bank, and 3 hours later, you know, he finally got his bank account set up. It was just such a pain in the butt. Now they're rolling out a new policy. They're making it easier for foreign tourists to link their WeChat and Alipay to a foreign credit card. And for an ATM card, so now they can go to China and use most of the places the mobile payment system, which is very super convenient once you have that set up. So there's no you know, people, if you go ask people who live in China about social credit system, they will draw a blank expression like what the hell is that. So that it's not a thing. It sounds like true, and it maybe it has some basis in the facts, maybe from the Chinese history in the past, but it's not a thing.
I got you. Yeah. So one of my listeners, excellent guest, real world experience, not theoretical. Does Mr. Zaw think we got a realistic representation of Tiananmen Square crackdown through Western media? And my friend JC here, so much of the fear mongering about China is the US projecting their own intentions, which I think is probably true. So I want to tell you what I kind of understand of Tiananmen Square, because I'm largely ignorant, and I know you covered it quite a bit, so maybe we could do like a brief synopsis. My understanding was that the people had got unruly, and I'm not sure exactly, I don't have a good recollection of the exact events, but the government had kind of came down and cracked down on them. I don't know the exact Western interpretation, but if you do, could you let me and my listeners know?
I'll try to make it brief. It's sure. Like I say, originally it's started from the public discontent about inflation and corruption. Okay. In fact, that's what was two major slogans was yelled out. And the trigger was passing away of the former communist secretary Hu Yaobang. So when Deng Xiaoping came to power, Deng Xiaoping actually, he's not a very hands-on type of guy. He delegated a lot of the actual reform and opening up to his deputies. So one of the Deng Xiaoping's right-hand man was Hu Yaobang, and he oversaw a lot of, one of the most important things he did was overturning kind of a lot of the cultural excess of the Cultural Revolution. So Hu Yaobang was very popular, but then in the mid to late 80s, because at that time there was a wave of student protests demanding like further reforms there was a lot of student protests in 1980s. I'll tell you, like, I experienced my first student protest in 1982 when I went to live with my dad on the campus of Chongqing University. There was in Chongqing, because that was the wartime capital of China in World War II, a lot of tunnels, a lot of anti-air raid shelters were dug in the mountains, and during Cultural Revolution, because China was preparing to go to war with both Soviet Union and United States. So even more shelters were dug underground and in the mountainside. And a lot of these extensive tunnels were leveraged to do other stuff. Like they put factories in there. When the Chongqing University, hey, come on. My dogs are going crazy.
That makes two of us. Don't feel bad.
they feel like they're United States. You know, they feel like they have a very wide jurisdiction. And like right now, they're on my third floor balcony, barking at people down below. And so, in Where was I? I was, my dogs kind of sidetracked me.
No, that's okay. Some of the protests in Tiananmen Square, you said, yeah.
Yeah. So, there was a lot of, I remember in 1982, the Chongqing University authorities, they decided to rent out a lot of these old, underground, shelters to like a lot of migrant workers from who are moving into the city from the countryside, and they're using them to raise mushrooms, right? Very entrepreneurial. And in one of the caves, they discover some kind of, you know, old experiment from, I guess, dating from Cultural Revolution, and some like migrant worker took out like some kind of device, but what they didn't know, it was like, it was radioactive. It was back then when they took out a radioactive device, but the migrant worker didn't know about it. So he thought, oh, okay, I can sell this for scrap. And later he became sick. And then the news spread like wildfire on campus. So a lot of students were pissed about this kind of this incident. So I remember, you know, like it was at night and all the students rushed out their door and they were beating on like, they're beating on like anything, like their pants and pots, and they put up slogans like "Huang Wo Qing Chun," like "Return to me my life, my youth," you know, like this is so. But it was a very festive atmosphere. It's like that's my experience with student protests. I just thought, okay, yeah, these college students, they just want an excuse for not going to school, and so we didn't think anything was different developing in 1980, in the late 80s and or toward 1989. But anyways, there was a wave of student protests in 1986, 87. And Hu Yaobang became the fall guy because at that time, at the top of the leadership, Deng Xiaoping was only like the first among equal. He's not the, you know, like the dictator. So the more conservative faction of the party, they wanted to kind of put a stop to they thought the reform was going too fast. China was like turning away from being socialist. And so in the end, Hu Yaobang became the fall guy. He's the one that was sacrificed, fall on the sword. So he was removed from his position, but he remained deeply popular. And in 1989, Hu Yaobang died. And during his funeral, the students they came to Tiananmen Square to spontaneous to mourn the passing away of a very popular leader. And then they turned out to became a protest for kind of the unfair treatment Hu Yaobang received for taking the fall. And then it became about official corruption, high inflation. So this started in April 1989, and it went on all the way till June. So period for 2 months, the students occupied the Tiananmen Square, the center of Beijing, more than a million people. And a lot of the kind of the city was kind of paralyzed. A lot of the, it was joined by, like I mentioned, by school teacher, nurses, police, people from all walks of life. The protests spread all over China in different cities. I think this triggered a lot of fear in the Chinese top leadership because most of the Chinese leadership experienced Cultural Revolution. And Cultural Revolution is a mass movement. You know, when Mao kind of mobilized all the young all the young students in particular to turn them against his own political opponents in the party. And like, because Cultural Revolution is another whole rabbit hole. But basically, Mao...
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. At that time, he felt like the Communist Party was betraying its ideal. It's turning into a bourgeois party, like Deng Xiaoping back then was cast as a capitalist rotor for like trying to return China back to capitalism. So Mao had Deng Xiaoping removed, but to remove Deng Xiaoping and his and Deng Xiaoping's peers, Mao kind of came out of semi-retirement. He mobilized the masses and mobilized the students to kind of smash down the party bureaucracy at that time. So a lot of the party elders in 1989, they kind of freaked out by the mass protests, because it reminded me of them of the Cultural Revolution, when a lot of them and their family members were struggled in struggle sessions and all that. But there was a split in the top party, in top Politburo. There was an even split. You know, half of the Politburo run cracked down, the half of the Politburo say, okay, maybe we should make some compromise with the students. So there was because of deadlock, the protest went on for 2 months in the center of Beijing. That's why even when Gorbachev flew in, they couldn't find a space for him to hold the reception in Tiananmen Square. They had to do it at the Beijing airport. And then in the end, the conservative faction won out, because they went to appeal directly to Deng Xiaoping, who was already kind of semi-retirement. And then Deng Xiaoping approved to clear the square. So they're sending the People's Liberation Army in to Beijing, but the army was blocked by the citizens from entering the city limit. By the way, at that time, everything was broadcasted on the state television. I think maybe part of it is because of the divide at the top of leadership. So everything, even though I didn't live in Beijing, I live in Chongqing, which is in the southwest part of China. Mm-hmm. Every day, people were glued to their television set to watch what's going on in Beijing. We even saw the army being stopped on the outskirts of Beijing, and the citizens blocking the army trucks and all that. What happened was in the morning of June 4th, that's one day the signal stopped. For like a whole day, and that's when we thought, oh shit, what's going on, something. And when the television went back on in late that evening, they said there was a counter-revolutionary riot that happened in Beijing, so the army had to take measures to put down the counter-revolutionary riot. And later they showed a lot of footages. So this is another thing people today don't realize. They actually show the footage of Tank Man on Chinese state television, broadcasted nationwide. And because they showed the entire footage of the Tank Man, because the Tank Man was blocking this column of tanks coming out of Tiananmen Square. So the tank is trying to go around him, but he wouldn't let the tank pass. And he even climbed onto the tank for a couple minutes and had a conversation with the tank commanders. And people can look it up. You know, you can find that on YouTube. There's a clip of the entire footage. And it was shot by foreign journalists on top of their hotel balcony. Most of the people, what people saw on in CNN, they only saw the cutoff part, the part that the guy was trying to block the tank movement. But the entire footage will show that he went up on the tank, had a conversation with the tank commander. He came back down, the tank tried to go around him again, and he will block the tank.
Yeah.
And then there will be a group of people on bicycles who rushed by and took him away. And that's the end of it. That's like the entire, he was not killed. He was not flattened.
Okay. I think that's probably what that picture's trying to depict there.
Yes.
This is what everybody knows of Tiananmen Square, and the Tank Man is just that picture in particular of the guy sitting in front of the tank. And I think that the idea is supposed to be, the Chinese government had crushed this protester and he was fighting for freedom or something like that. But it seems like, you know, it didn't quite go that way by what you're saying, that it was kind of like a friendly thing, actually.
Well, the framing in the Chinese state television at the end is like, oh, look at this clown trying to stop our tank and our tank commander. Our yeah. tank commander was being reasonable, trying, you know, doing the maximum, show extreme or extraordinary restraint. Right? That's how the position of the Chinese state. But now we know there was a bloodshed. It was shooting, but it didn't happen on the Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square is where the majority of the students camped out. So there were shooting on the way to the Tiananmen Square, particularly in a place called Muxidi. So this is where it gets kind of hazy because the army claimed that there were snipers from the roof on the apartment buildings that was shooting at the army that was advancing into the city. And they return fire. So this, you know, this is verified. There's an excellent documentary called The Gate of Heavenly Peace by an American documentary filmmaker. People can look it up. It's on YouTube. It's actually one of the better Tiananmen documentary produced by Americans. And there was so what happened was the army shot back at those buildings. So, you know, some people were killed in the buildings, in their homes, because by the stray bullets, and there was this apparently enraged the crowd. So a lot of crowds at that time they built barricades to block the army columns. A lot of the Beijing public buses were piled up on the streets, lit on fire to block the column of tanks, and some they were actually able to stop. Two tanks, a couple of tanks and armored personnel carrier, they set the tanks on fire with Molotov cocktail. Oh. And when the soldiers got out, they were lynched and their body were hanged from the bridge. And we were shown those graphic footages when I was in. So when we went back to school in 1989. So the government produced a documentary about the Tiananmen Square. So everybody, it's a required showing. So everybody show. So that it was kind of traumatizing for me to see like the burned bodies of soldiers, with, like their intestines coming out and their body is completely charcoaled and so this is the government side of the story. They say, oh, this is a counter-revolutionary riot, and then the army trying to restore order. But of course it's a different version presented on CNN, you know, like, but anyway, like there was a lot of chaos and there was bloodshed. There was a group called the Tiananmen Mothers who, the people who lost their children, for 10, 20 years, they were going around verifying information, like, network to find out the names of the people who died of the protesters. So they came up about 200 names. So I think that's probably around the number of the figure of people who were killed. But by the time the army reached the center of the Tiananmen Square, the protest leaders, they went to negotiate with the army commander, and they came up to came up to a settlement where the protest leader agreed they would take the students away to leave the square. So that process was largely peaceful, except one freak accident when an armored personnel carrier, for some reason, lost control and ran into a crowd of people who were leaving the square, and like 11 people were killed. And that was the number of people who were killed on the Tiananmen Square, 11 people. And I highly recommend the Gate of Heavenly Peace documentary. I think that's most reasonable documentary on the Tiananmen Square protest by an American filmmaker. Some of the protest leaders didn't come out very good. For example, Tsai Ling, she was caught on film saying like, oh, our goal is to create bloodshed because only with blood we can wake up the Chinese people's consciousness. So we cannot leave the Tiananmen Square. That was one of the biggest conflict among the students because they were debating before the army came in whether they should leave the square or stay. And Tsai Ling was one of the hardliners. She said, we have to stay. But on camera, she was talking to American film crew, and she said, "I cannot tell them that our goal is to create bloodshed, to force the government to open fire, let the bloodshed wake up the consciousness of the Chinese people." And in the end, he was asked by the American film crew, like, "Would you stay in the Tiananmen Square?" She said, "No." He said, "I'm too important. You know, I feel like my life is not." Yeah, she said that. And Tsai Ling was ferried out by the CIA carry out operation called the Yellow Bird. So there was a Yellow Bird to operation carried out by CIA to ferry out the major protest leaders out through Hong Kong to the United States. And Tsai Ling went to American University on scholarship, and he worked for hedge funds investment on Wall Street. And he. She's a typical American success story. And she became a born again Christian and all that. So you know, she's very 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 much assimilated. And so that's the kind of the broad stroke of the Tiananmen Square protests. At that time, it was the crackdown was deeply unpopular among the Chinese people. Mm-hmm. And I remember the mood right after Tiananmen Square, and that's why that led to Chinese economy kind of ground into a halt because at the time there was Western sanctions applied to China in the immediate aftermath of the Tiananmen Square. I remember that summer the oranges became super cheap because previously all the best fruits local produce all exported abroad for hard currency. But because of sanctions, suddenly it was like, oh, the oranges are so cheap this year and we could eat as much oranges as we want. And so China went on a major diplomatic offensive. So before 1990, China didn't recognize Israel. China didn't have a relationship with South Korea. It didn't have a relationship with Indonesia, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, South Africa. Now after 1990, they still didn't establish a relationship with apartheid South Africa, but they recognized Israel in 1992, mm-hmm. they recognized South Korea in 1990, they normalized tie with Singapore and Indonesia in 1990. And one of the deal they made with the Chinese people is that, okay, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't challenge the government. And I remember in United States, like the Chinese Student Association, you know, was seen as kind of arms of the government. So they're also not very popular with the Chinese exchange students. So they will do things like try to lure the Chinese students back into the fold by offering like services. They'll hold free movie nights. They'll show Chinese movie. They'll provide food and snacks. And then, you know, like my parents' colleagues, they were like, okay, yeah, we don't like the government, but it's free food and free movies. So we'll go. And then they will do things like set up dating service for the Chinese students and try to like help them like write a resume, find a job. So eventually that strategy worked because I remember in 1990, they were deeply unpopular, but that the perception started to change. And interestingly, because I lived in the United States for 30 years, I actually got to know a lot of the former student protesters who now live in the United States, live and work in the United States. Majority of them, their view on the protests nowadays probably will shock most Americans. Their view now is that the protests needed to end.
Okay, so it's kind of funny because I have a friend who does a lot of the same kind of work that I'm doing right now, you know, when it comes to like this whole Cold War and propaganda against China. And he had mentioned one of our friend had like the normie view of Tiananmen Square where they thought that it was, you know, the government being oppressive towards the people. But though he said, oh, no, actually, it was like the people that kind of needed to be quelled, if you will. Not saying that they should have been slaughtered, but
let me phrase it a different way. So
sure,
most of the former protesters now they have come to the view that The protests need to end. The China need to return to normalcy. They didn't like the way it ended, you know, that it ended right. Bloodshed. But they're saying you should end. And the one biggest reason that helped them to achieve their conclusion is the collapse of Soviet Union. To see what happened to Russia and the former Soviet bloc, and to witness kind of the economic takeoff of China in 1990. Because when I came to the United States in 1990, there weren't that many made in China goods. I remember when we went Christmas shopping with my parents, we saw a teddy bear that was made in China. It was like a novelty. We're like, oh wow, made in China. So my parents bought it for me, even though I was like 13 already. And they bought a made in China teddy bear. But like a few years after that, it's like made in China everywhere on the shelves. And that's a big, big transformation because, like I said, China suffered economically after 1989 crackdown, and because the party conservative faction that kind of won and that, you know, advocated for the crackdown, they were in charge. They kind of wanted to roll back the pace of reform. They want China to return back to the true path of socialism. But Deng Xiaoping didn't like that. That wasn't his plan. So in 1992, even though Deng Xiaoping is officially completely retired, you know, like the only official title he had back then was like the president of All China Bridge Club, like the card game Bridge Club. But he still have a lot of clout. So he did a so-called Southern Tour. You know, he went to the special economic zone of Shenzhen, which is right opposite of Hong Kong. Shenzhen used to be a fishing village in 1970s when I was born. And they decided at that time when China first decided to open and reform, they say, okay, well, this is an experiment. We don't know how it's going to go. So we're going to designate a certain special economic zones where they will introduce market reforms. If it doesn't go well, we'll just shut it down. It's fine. But if it goes well, we can, you know, adopt it and maybe spread it elsewhere. So they actually built walls. So first of all, there's walls between mainland China and Hong Kong, but they also built walls around Shenzhen to like quarantine it off around from the rest of the China. And then in Shenzhen, they allow a more kind of like free-willing allow the market to take over. And that's when they invited a lot of the investors from Hong Kong, from Taiwan to come and set up factories. And so Deng Xiaoping traveled to Shenzhen in 1992. And he said, everything looks good to me. I don't see why there's no reason why every other Chinese city could be like this. So after Deng Xiaoping said that was kind of the 180. That kind of opened up the floodgate for the Chinese economic liberalization. Basically, the economic reform was no longer just limited to like this small coastal cities. It was kind of promoted everywhere. Of course, there was a lot of pain. There's a lot of economic transition, especially in 1997, when there was a mass privatization effort. So that's when the Chinese government decided, you know, we don't need to be in charge of all aspects of the economy. We just need to control the pillar industries like oil and gas industry, the finance, the defense industry, and the rest, all the smaller medium enterprises, they can all go private. And this mass privatization like drastically changed the Chinese economy. You know, like I said before, it's a lot easier to keep tabs on you when everybody works in the state-owned industry. But after that, you know, you can go have your own business, own your own business. So a lot of my parents' generation who came to United States in 1980s, many of them stayed in U.S., got their green card, got their U.S. citizenship, working the corporate world in U.S. for like 10, 20 years. Around 2000, many of my dad's former classmates went back to China because in U.S. they have hit a glass ceiling in the corporate world because maybe their language skills or I don't know, interpersonal skill. I don't know, whatever. Because they heard us hit a certain corporate ceiling, glass ceiling that could rise no longer. But if they go back to China, they can be CEOs, they can be founder of companies, can be VIPs, and the sky is the limit. So that's when my dad, he didn't go back because he was already pretty old when he came to when he came to US as an exchange student, he was already in his mid 40s. So he felt like, okay, I'm pretty comfortable working for GM, and you know, I just work until I get my pension. And so, but most of his more ambitious classmates all went back to China. And this is also another reason why a lot of the former student protesters changed their minds about the protest, because they saw what happened. They saw the collapse in total social economic collapse in post-Soviet Russia. And they saw the economic takeoff in China. And they came to the realization, you know what? I didn't like what Deng Xiaoping did, but he was right. He was right to end the protest in 1990.
Okay, so I guess in our last 20 minutes, one thing I really wanted to talk to you about was about BRICS and how you kind of feel about that. And you had kind of planted a little bit of a seed in my mind. You know, the border is a big political football right now. And I remember listening to you on the Revolutionary Blackout Network saying, oh, only 20,000 Chinese people came across the border in 2023. And when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, he was right. And what do you hear from the populist right now all the time? China's invading through our southern border. And when I looked up your numbers, I'm like, this is like not even 2% of the overall people. So like, if you are concerned about the people coming across the border, you shouldn't be concerned about the Chinese, because that's like this much compared to all the other people. Like, are you stupid? Can you not like read numbers? So I when you said that, I'm like, this is insanity. So I guess what's your perspective on like the U.S. empire as it is and kind of geopolitics is going right now?
Well, U.S. empire is declining. It's kind of struggling everywhere right now. I mean, the right now it's doing a two-front war in Ukraine and Middle East. And you know, U.S. Admiral was quoted saying right now, the operation in Red Sea is the largest battle the U.S. Navy have engaged in since World War II. And you're losing. You're losing against Houthis. Yemen is now a major world naval power. They're redirecting 11% of the world traffic from Red Sea to around the Cape of Good Hope. I mean, this is kind of the incompetence of the most powerful empire in the world, and they want to take on China. You kidding me? You can't even defeat the Houthis.
You want to go fight a war with China, which is 7,000 miles off your coast. And every single time our own military games out this stuff, we lose 3,000 people within a month. Like, bad.
And China has 200 times the shipbuilding capability of the United States. You know, you lose a ship, you're not going to be able to replace it for many, many years in U.S. at the current industrial deindustrialization state of United States. You know, that's, you know, you have articles like U.S. Navy goes to South Korean and Japanese ship makers to help U.S. Navy naval buildup. Yeah. So like I used to say, you know, at least The only thing that's made in America are weapons and OnlyFans, but apparently that's not even true anymore. You know, you have to go to South Korea and Japan to help your naval build up because you don't have the capability at home anymore. And this is all self-inflicted.
You know,
the Wall Street people, they intentionally moved hollow out the manufacturing in U.S. because they can make more money by shifting it to East Asia. And they did that, like they were doing that since 1970s, you know, even before China opened up, before they were just shifting factories to South Korea, to Taiwan, to Southeast Asia. It's just, so when China opened up, they went to China because it was even cheaper then. And Chinese government adopted a very smart policy, because their policy is basically, if you build it, they will come. We'll give them tax incentives. We'll give them like land usage. and like the way the deal they gave to Tesla is like, we won't even force you to have joint ventures with Chinese partners. You can have 100% owned factory in Shanghai. Only condition we have is you need to produce a certain amount of the components that goes into Tesla need to come from Chinese suppliers. So Tesla gig factory in Shanghai actually created a whole ecosystem of the Chinese EV suppliers who, like, you know, quickly ramped up their own a tech tree. So now those Chinese suppliers can turn around and supply the Chinese EV makers. And and so that kind of, it was one of the big fundamental game shifter in the Chinese auto industry. Now all the, because for 20, 30 years, the foreign automakers were able to keep the Chinese automaker at bay, because a lot of people don't know, but GM makes more cars in China. They make more profit in China than this. China is the world's largest car market for cars, right? GM, and I remember 2010, I went back to China. This is still kind of the part of the great financial crisis. I went to see my dad's old friend. He has a daughter who was same age as me. She worked at the GM China, and she was like, "We don't know what GM America is doing, man. We are making money here in China. We're making money head over fist. Why is GM America going bankrupt? I don't understand." But the foreign automakers were able to keep the Chinese car makers couple generations behind, because the assembly line, the product line that moved to China is always like two generations behind, and so when they form joint ventures, you know like the Chinese are only learning how to make cars as two generations behind. But with EV, now the Chinese car maker are leapfrogging the whole technology. Because you just need batteries. Like, Chinese know how to make batteries. You know, BYD, they're already world's largest battery maker.
So this is really interesting, because funny enough, I actually work for a General Motors dealership, and I started for a Chevrolet dealership back in 2013. And I recently went to school about a year or two ago and did all my hybrids vehicle training. And right now we're struggling to get the new Hummers in. We're starting to get some Lyrics in with some frequency, but when we get them, that they're crap. They have so many different little fickle issues, and like, when you drive them, they're wonderful. I mean, it is quick, it's quiet, they're comfortable. I love everything about them, but like, we just don't get them that much. So by the way that you're kind of explaining it, I'm guessing that there's probably a lot more over in Asian countries than there are here in America.
You know, like Buick used to be a big brand in China.
That's like a running joke here. Yeah.
Yeah. My cousin got his first car was a Buick, because at the time everyone wanted a Buick. But now with the transition to EVs, all the legacy ICE car makers are in trouble in China, because the new cars sold in China this year, 40% are EVs.
Here in America, it's as of last year, it was 5.9%. Yeah. I literally just looked at it this morning. And then as of this year, I think it's trending towards 8%. And then in like 2020-ish, it was like 3%. So we're going about like a percent or two a year. And the government's doing everything they can to like push people towards this stuff. But everybody wants their big old crossovers, their trucks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't have big trucks, EV trucks. The problem is US don't have the infrastructure. You don't have the charging stations. And even if you put in the charging station, guess what? Your power grid won't be able to support more EVs.
Correct.
Like China is all about building excessive capacity. China adds new power generations year by year. In US, all the privatized power utility companies, They're not interested in building excessive capacity. They're interested in to squeeze more money out of the existing grid. And so this is where you get a situation where when you get a freak weather condition like Texas, people freeze their ass off because there's no excessive capacity. And on top of that, because the U.S. grid is also kind of disjointed and they don't have China has this. This is where China leads in the world IP, by the way. They have this new technology called the ultra high voltage direct current transmission power line that will allow them to pipe power all the way from southwest China, where there's plenty of hydro power, all the way to Shanghai with minimum power loss. And now, like, U.S. don't have that technology. I mean, like right now, everything, all the patent, all the instruction about ultra high power direct current transmission, it's all in Chinese. You have to learn Chinese to be able to understand this technology. But U.S., even when Texas was going through that freak storm, you know, they don't have these long distance transmission lines, say from California or elsewhere, to pipe in that power, even if the other grids have excessive capacity. So U.S. is falling behind in infra. I mean, we know this is like infrastructure, right? China built high speed rail network. U.S. like California high speed rail is a joke. I mean, both started around the same time. 2008 was when China started rolling out its first high speed rail. And I remember because 2008, I was in LA. I was dating a Japanese girl who worked in the Japanese consulate, and her job was to show the take the Japanese delegation around the town. And at that time, the Japanese delegation were coming to LA to talk with the state government of California to talk about constructing the high-speed rail. That was 2008. I mean, right now, China is covered with high-speed rail and California, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, and this has been a huge propaganda piece with, there's quite a few, but we'll start with this one. What is going on with the Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang province? I have an idea, but, and a friend of mine had done quite a bit of research into this, but I want to know your perspective on this, because back in 2019, you might be aware that Donald Trump and the CIA had launched a campaign against China. So I suspect that this is part of it, but what's exactly happening over there?
So first of all, right now, every time you see Uyghur genocide trending on social media, you should find out what Israel is doing, because it's usually when Israel is doing some fuck up shit, and then you'll have Uyghur genocide suddenly trending on social media.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and it's by some small follower account too. It's like some guy was like 200, 300 followers. Something.
Yeah, first name, these bunch of numbers.
Yes, and so in China, there's no Uyghur genocide. You know, call me genocide denier all you want, but there's
that makes
no
two Uyghur of us.
There's no Uyghur genocide, and it's actually making a mockery of the Holocaust by saying there's an Uyghur genocide. And so there was a security crackdown in Xinjiang. This because there was a series of terrorist incident in Xinjiang and then in the rest of China. People can look it up. In 2014, in particular, March 1st, 2014, there was a Kunmin train station attack with a group of Uyghur terrorists. They went to the Kunmin train station. They just took out knife and stabbed anyone they could. And, you know, 30 people died. 30 people died, more wounded. And this is... And there was an attack in Tiananmen Square. So this was a group of Uyghurs who were driving a van to run over people on Tiananmen Square. You know, this happened, like, I think this actually happened a couple of years before, like similar type of attacks were occurring in Europe. And so in response to that, there was a crackdown in security crackdown. In fact, a lot of the radical Uyghurs were trying to leave China and go to Syria. They were leaving Xinjiang. At that time, during the Syrian war, early phase of Syrian war, Turkey was still very part of the NATO war on Syria. So Turkey has a deal where any Uyghurs reach the Turkish consulate in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, they will get a Turkish passport, which allow them to board the flight to Turkey, to Istanbul. And right when they get off the plane at Istanbul, they will be greeted by jihadist recruiters who tell them to go to Syria. And this is how you get thousands of Uyghur fighters in Syria, in northwest Syria, in Idlib province, with their families. So some people estimate somewhere around like 5,000 Uyghur fighters together with their families. They estimate like somewhere between like 10,000, 20,000 Uyghurs in northwest Syria. And this was part of the CIA-funded Operation Timber Sycamore, which is the largest CIA operation after Operation Cyclone, which was the one against Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So this is to funnel global jihadists to Syria to overthrow Assad. So China at that time was trying to close the border so these people wouldn't leave. And you know, you can still look for news around that time in 20, for example, in around 2014, 2015, that time frame, there were border incidents in China and Vietnam where Uyghurs, they took out, they had a fight with a Vietnamese border guard. They took their guns and shot some people. And there were Uyghurs, jihadists being captured in Indonesia. And there were bombing in Bangkok in 2015 by Uyghurs with quote unquote fake Turkish passport. And then, because at that time there was a US, So because at the time the China locked down the border or around the Xinjiang with Central Asia, but they could travel freely within China. So, you know, it's very easy to hop on a high speed train and they can go to southwestern China where the border with a neighbor country is a lot more porous. So then they could travel to Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, then go down to Cambodia and go down to Malaysia where they will get their Turkish passport. But there were many incidents where Thai authorities, Cambodian authority, Vietnamese authority were detaining these Uyghurs coming out of China. And there was actually a diplomatic battle between U.S. government and Cambodia threatening them if they repatriate these Uyghurs to China that U.S. will cut off the aid. But, you know, Cambodia was already receiving the aids from China. So Cambodia repatriated those Uyghurs. But the Thailand, they did a Solomon's justice. They're like, okay, so the men go back to China and the women go to Turkey. But the Uyghur jihadists still was not very happy. That's why they did the 2015 bombing in Bangkok. And you guys can Google that, verify that. And so after 2017, there was a tighter security crackdown in Xinjiang. So they had they constructed these. So in U.S. they call them camps. They call them concentration camps.
Re-education camps.
I think probably better term would be de-radicalization centers because that's what their main purpose was. The main purpose was to send the people who have been radicalized to these de-radicalization centers, and after a certain period of time, to reintegrate them back to the society. So what's very little known or reported in U.S. media is Chinese government had made an announcement in around June 2019 that all these camps were closed, and all the people have been successfully reintegrated into society. So there's actually a Washington Post article, I think maybe from 2020. They did travel to Xinjiang. They confirmed the camps were closed, but you know they still continue with their China bad
with the propaganda. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I mean, there are Uyghur people in China on social media right now. There are people who travel to Xinjiang. Like by the way, Xinjiang is not a restricted region. If you have a Chinese visa, you can travel to Xinjiang. Which is for Tibet, you actually need you need to sign with a group tour to go to Tibet. But Xinjiang, you just go. You can just go if you have Chinese visas. You can go to YouTube and find lot of recent travel logs of Western bloggers, even Indian bloggers, who travel through Xinjiang and show how what their experience was. I mean, it's ridiculous to say there was a genocide going on, especially today, given what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had this theory, and I'm sure you'd probably agree with it, that like I legitimately think that there's probably some money changing hands by the Israeli lobby to push out all this anti-China propaganda, because everything that that the U.S. is accusing China of, Israel is actually guilty of. So I want to be respectful of your time. I got one more question for you, if you got a few more minutes.
Sure.
What is your opinion on what is going on between China and Taiwan? Because if you're familiar with Tim Pool, who's probably one of the largest voices in alt media today, he is the largest China hawk in the world. And usually my Twitter blows up whenever I tag him and make fun of him for being such a China hawk. But if you listen to him or anybody on the populist right today, who once again, I consider these my people. I'm a blue collar guy. I grew up working in dealerships, fixing cars. If you listen to any of these people talk about China and Taiwan, they're basically giving you the impression that China is going to go take Taiwan tomorrow. But my understanding is, and it seems by all intentions of Chinese officials, that they want peaceful reunification, but do not rule out the use of force if the West continues to stick their finger right in China's eye, which the West can't seem to stop doing. So what's your opinion of what's going on there, and what do you make of all of that?
Well, I mean, right now, the most concern about Taiwan you will hear is from the Anglo media. You know, like I have a friend in Taiwan right now. He went back to Taiwan to serve the mandatory draft service, and he just completed his service. You know, like people in Taiwan are not concerned about the imminent invasion. It's the people in America who are reading these mainstream media think there's going to be a World War III kicking off anytime soon. Because there's no reason for China to make a military move right now. Because Taiwan issue right now is not the issue between mainland China and Taiwan. It's really an issue between China and United States. Mm-hmm. But the longer China waits, the stronger China's position become, you know, because Chinese economy is still growing in spite of all this collapse story you hear on the media. Chinese economy is still growing, and it's still catching up to US year by year. So China in 2027 will be stronger vis-a-vis United States than it's today. But China in 2032 will be even stronger. So it doesn't make sense for China to rush this right now when time is on their side. Their economy is growing. Their navy is growing. China is probably going to make another aircraft carrier pretty soon. And so there's no... but what is happening is it looks like the particularly the defense industry in the military industrial complex in the U.S., they have a vested interest to stir up the tensions in the Taiwan Strait so they can continue to sell weapons to Taiwan, because Taiwan is one of the best customers for very expensive but outdated weapon system from the United States. But what China is doing is they are not doing it through a they're doing it a very kind of what this is what the U.S. calls the salami slicing or the gray zone aggression. So, for example, recently U.S. deployed special forces, Green Berets, to Kinmen Islands. People can Google where Kinmen Islands is.
It's off the coast of China.
So this is Taiwan Island. This is mainland China. Kinmen Island is on the other side of the Taiwan Strait, right next to the main coast of China. So U.S. deploys Green Berets on Kinmen Islands, 2 kilometers from the Chinese coast. I mean, this is an act of provocation. I mean, let's face it. A dozen special forces in Kinmen Islands is not going to do shit in a Chinese amphibious assault on the island.
Yeah.
But what they what they do serve is as trip wire forces. You know, the idea is like, oh, Americans are being trapped on the island. Americans being captured by the PLA. This will be a cost for dragging the U.S. into war.
Let's put the shoe on the other foot. What would we do as in the U.S. if there were Chinese troops in the Bahamas or something like that, or right off the coast of Florida? I mean, you
this
know,
is
Joe Biden.
Bahamas. This is like Catalina Island right next to Los Angeles.
But, you know, Trump or Biden would hit the nuke button immediately. They would say, what the hell are these Chinese troops doing on our coast? But though we're allowed to go do it over there. And you see all the news articles that, you know, we sail all these warships through the Taiwan Strait. We have all these planes flying right off the coast of China. And then you'll see a news article the next day saying China is acting irresponsibly in the South China Sea. It's like, well, what the hell are we doing in the South China Sea? We're the American Army. Let's bring everybody home and leave China do what they're going to do. Because if Taiwan wants to be a part of China, that's not our business. That's 8,000 miles away from us. Why can't we have a good relationship with both these countries? And, you know, if we're going to be involved in it, say like, hey, why don't we help them negotiate a peace or just make sure that relationships are good? Why do we have to fight a war with them? It's boggled my mind, but this has been the goal since the Obama administration.
There's no money in peace, Kyle. There's no money in peace for the military industrial complex. Right. I mean, because right now, economically, U.S. cannot compete with China in Asia Pacific. I mean, mm-hmm. I just look at the investment figures. The Chinese investment in Southeast Asia dwarf Chinese U.S. investment in Southeast Asia. Yeah. So the only thing that U.S. can offer is weapons, and military bases. Right. So that's where we are today. China is not. I think right now China and Taiwan are both okay with the status quo as is, because
but the U.S.
is Taiwan is always okay with status quo, but China it's gathering its strength. It's still building up its navy. It's still growing its economy. So the balance is already tipping in their favor, but it was going to tip even more, say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. There's no hurry on Chinese leadership side to push the Taiwan button today, because that could possibly trigger a direct military confrontation with the United States, which is not what they're looking to do right now. I mean, wait 10 years, all the U.S. Navy ship will be rust bucket, and they can't replace them. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, Carl, you've been very, very generous with your time. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I would love to have you back on, and I would love to get you in with some of my other libertarian friends, because I think they would get a lot of benefit from talking to you as well. Where can everybody find you and follow you? Because I really think people should check out your work and hear some of the stuff you're talking about, because I found this conversation to be absolutely fascinating.
So I do have a YouTube channel, just my name, Carl Za. You can look it up. I am a prolific shit poster on Twitter. So
we like you. We like you for that.
I say shit poster, so don't take everything I post seriously. You know, a lot of time I just do it for fun. And
my audience will like you more for that. I promise.
I like to provoke people. But I also run my own podcast on Patreon, a Silk and Steel podcast, where I talk about everything about China, history, politics, and culture. And I'm doing a chronological retelling of the Chinese history all the way from the beginning. Now where I'm at like 535 BC. So I have a long way to go. I have a couple thousand years to go.
It's just a couple thousand. It's no big deal. Yeah. All right, Carl. Well, if you don't have anything else, I'll close her out. And like I said, I would love to do this again sometime, because I just find these conversations to be very, very necessary in our current times.
Indeed. Invite me back anytime. You know, I love to talk. We'll just find time for it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Carl.
Sure.